This episode is brought to you in part by Bayer. Bayer develops digital tools to help farmers use less water to grow their crops. From advances in health to innovations in agriculture, Bayer is advancing science for a better life. At Bayer, this is why we science. Welcome to the Science Podcast for December 13th, 2019. I'm Sarah Crespi. On this week's show, staff writer Jennifer Cousin-Frankel talks about the hunt for new epilepsy treatments. And I talk with Toysten Norbert about using an instrument on the International Space Station to record a gamma ray flash produced by a thunderstorm. Now we have Jennifer Cousin-Frankel. She's a staff writer for the Science News team. This week, she wrote about the hunt for new epilepsy treatments. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, sure. So I was surprised to learn from your story how common epilepsy is. How many people have epilepsy, and how exactly is it defined?
Well, 1 in 26 people will develop epilepsy over the course of their lifetime. And epilepsy is in some ways an unusual disease because it's really defined largely by its most striking symptom, which is seizures, repeated seizures.
It sounds like a lot of people have this, but what made you decide to write about the treatments for epilepsy now?
Well, there were two things that jumped out at me and really captured my attention and drew me to this story. The first is that about 30% of patients continue to have seizures despite taking medication to try and treat those seizures.
Wow.
That's considered drug-resistant epilepsy. That just seemed like a really high number to me. There are a lot of drugs out there to treat epilepsy, and yet you still have that 30% of patients who continue to suffer from seizures. That was the first piece of information. And the second, just a striking piece of information, is that that percentage really has not changed over many years, even though there have been a number of new drugs approved to treat epilepsy. So the fact that there was this high percentage that was unchanging or largely unchanging despite new therapies really grabbed me, because it suggested that we need to do something differently here to help many of these patients.
Can you talk a little bit about why having treatment-resistant epilepsy is not a great thing?
Yeah, so it's really hard for a lot of these patients. This is a really varied group of people. Some of these are people, kids and adults, who might have a form of epilepsy called focal epilepsy that's pretty common and that affects a specific region of the brain. So someone who has focal epilepsy that's drug resistant can wake up every morning not knowing whether they're going to have a seizure that day. And you're living with this very intense unpredictability in your life, in addition to living with the seizures and living with the side effects of the medications that you're often taking to continue to try and control them. For other patients, it can be very devastating. If the seizures are really uncontrolled, they could be having multiple seizures a day. Very young children and babies that have many, many seizures can suffer developmental delays and other problems as a result of that. Mm-hmm. You know, as you can imagine, it can be really hard to live with. Even if the seizures aren't that frequent, even if we're just talking a few seizures a year, that can still be very disruptive and can make it difficult to live your life the way you want to.
So when you started to look into this question of why isn't the needle moving? Why is treatment-resistant epilepsy still so common when new drugs are coming on the market? What did you find? What's going on there?
Traditionally, the drugs that are out there treat the seizures, which is kind of the end of the story here. That's the end point of the disease, is you have a seizure and the drugs target the seizures. And it's true that for many patients, that really works well and kind of does what you need it to do. But we're also talking about what doctors refer to as a really heterogeneous disease, a disease that has varied causes. And for many patients, we don't really or haven't historically really understood the cause of the seizures. So it's kind of almost flipping the pages backwards in the book, what brought us to the seizure in this particular patient, and trying to understand the biology behind it. And I think the belief of many doctors and scientists is that we need to do that for many of these drug-resistant patients to more effectively target and control their seizures.
Once you begin breaking down this heterogeneous group, you have things like little kids, infants, genetic predisposition, traumatic brain injury, infection, like all these very different factors associated with the onset of seizures. How are they taking this on and kind of trying to find what leads from that initial insult to seizures?
It's a huge job and there's huge variation here. I don't think that one person can cover it all. And I don't know that anyone...
Not even in their story.
No, right, exactly. And that was a real challenge with this story too, is really trying to put it all together without overwhelming the reader or the writer for that matter. But yeah, I think you have different people who are kind of coming at this from different angles. So like you say, there is this subset of genetic syndromes, babies that are born with certain gene variants that then cause seizures, and they might cause other challenges as well. And so in that case, there are efforts to maybe develop animal models that carry that same gene variant or a very similar gene variant, and then study those models and test drugs in them.
Talking about animal models, you mentioned that there is this change there as well, as instead of inducing seizures in animal models, it's looking for ones that have seizures naturally in order to really study what's going on.
Yeah. So the history with the animal models was actually really interesting. The earliest animal models, which were developed many decades ago, involved inducing seizures one at a time, initially with electroshocks. And now people also use chemicals to induce a seizure and then see if you can treat it with a drug. In some ways, that's a model that's easier to work with because you have control over it. But these are animals that have otherwise healthy brains. And, you know, you're causing that seizure to happen exactly at the time of your choosing. But those models have been really useful at helping us identify a number of anti-seizure drugs and, you know, anti-epilepsy drugs that are on the market today. But in the last several years, there was concern that if we just keep using these models, we're not going to branch out in the kinds of treatments we find. And we're using animals whose brains are not really the same as the brains of people who are dealing with epilepsy.
So we talked about the genetic underpinnings and some attempt to tackle those. What about these other things? Like, for example, sometimes a severe infection can bring on seizures.
There are definitely cases of severe infection or a very prolonged, very high fever. Now, some of these types of epilepsy are really uncommon, although they can be especially devastating. But some of that work has been scientifically really interesting because it's led scientists to consider different strategies. For example, looking at inflammation in the brain and inflammatory molecules and targeting those, which is not something we usually think about is associated with epilepsy, but there's a lot of interest in that now. And part of that is in this world of infection-induced epilepsies.
Normally, when you think about epilepsy, you might think about channels and how neurons fire rather than, you know, what's going on with inflammation or immunity.
Yep.
One more thread that we could pick up here is traumatic brain injuries being associated with seizures. What kind of research is being done with those types of epilepsy?
So this area is really interesting because in this case, you have a brain injury, and then you have a time lag before someone develops epilepsy as a result of that injury. And that is a window of opportunity that researchers want to harness now and use to try and prevent epilepsy in these patients. So the work is still pretty new, and we're not at the point where we can prevent this or have any kind of therapy to prevent it. But there is a big effort now to try and identify which of these patients are at especially high risk, and then look for drugs or other treatments that can change that trajectory so that person doesn't develop seizure disorder, or, you know, maybe has a much milder disorder or one that's more responsive to medications.
This reminds me of another point you make in the story. Epilepsy is the end point. Sometimes we know the starting point, sometimes we don't. But what we really care about, what the researchers really care about, is the arc from the starting point to epilepsy. That's what they want to trace. And it just seems like there are so many different paths. One we haven't talked about is focal epilepsy.
Yep, that's exactly right. One of the most common forms of epilepsy, focal epilepsy. In that case, you know, we often don't know the cause, although people are still working to understand that. But another strategy one can use, instead of trying to dig down and get at the mechanism, if we don't have a mechanism, is looking at the drugs and thinking, okay, we have a drug. It doesn't work for everybody. Let's better understand this drug and why it fails in some patients. And how can we modify it or create a new drug that enhances its effectiveness. So that's another area of interest for drug companies and others to try and understand the biochemistry here and the chemistry of the drugs and what they're doing in the brain, which we, even with approved drugs, we don't always understand. And then understand why in someone who's not being helped by a particular medication, what can we do to make it better for them so that it can better blunt their seizures.
I was surprised to see how many different kinds of drugs that these researchers were trying. They were really going far afield. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that researchers are really trying to cast a wide net here, and they're looking both at drugs that are already approved and out there, even much older drugs that might help or at least might guide us to something that might help, as well as, you know, newer experimental drugs. So that can include everything from, you know, a particular anti-inflammatory drug to, in one case, a very old antihistamine that seemed to target a genetic form of epilepsy. You know, and again, this, it's all in the early stages, and these are really specific, narrow treatments. And often we don't always understand why they work. Sometimes we do, but sometimes we don't, or why they help certain people. So I think what people are realizing more and more is that epilepsy is such a varied disease. You're not going to find one drug that helps that whole 30% of patients who are still having seizures despite treatment. But the hope is that we can break them down into really narrow groups and then find drugs that maybe through very unexpected avenues do help.
Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Jennifer Cousin-Frankel is a staff news writer for Science. You can find a link to her story at sciencemag.org/podcast. Stay tuned for an interview with Torsten Neubert about lightning, gamma rays, and elves. This week's episode is also brought to you in part by Lightstream. The holidays are here, and this year you can give yourself the gift of extra money in your pocket. Pay off your credit card balances and save with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Roll your high-interest credit card payments into just one payment at a lower fixed rate. Lightstream's credit card consolidation loans have rates as low as 5.95% APR with autopay. You could save thousands in interest. Plus, there are no fees, no application fees, no origination fees, no transaction fees, no prepayment penalties. The application is quick and easy, and you can apply right from your phone. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. If you visit their site, you can see their transparency as well. Just for Science Podcast listeners, apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/sciencemag, lightstream.com/sciencemag, subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/sciencemag for more information. This week's episode is also brought to you in part by KiwiCo. KiwiCo creates hands-on projects for kids of all ages to make learning about STEAM fun. This holiday season, a KiwiCo subscription makes a perfect gift for every young explorer, engineer, and artist in your life. KiwiCo is defining the future of play by making it engaging, enriching, and seriously fun. They create hands-on projects and toys designed to expose kids to concepts in STEM, art, and design. Their mission? To help kids build creative confidence and problem-solving skills and have a blast doing it. There are 7 lines to choose from, catered for different age groups and topics like the Panda Crate for babies or the Eureka Crate for kids 14+. Each box comes with all the supplies needed for that month's project, plus detailed kid-friendly instructions. KiwiCo projects are available via flexible monthly subscriptions or for individual purchase, which means you can buy someone a couple months or one box or a year's worth of boxes. They have gifts for kids of all ages, so there's something for everyone on your list. KiwiCo is offering you the chance to get your first month for free. To redeem this offer and learn more about their projects, visit kiwico.com/sciencemag. It's very rare to see TLEs, transient luminous events. These are colorful lights in the sky high above thunderstorms. We're talking things like red sprites, blue jets, gamma ray flashes, and even the fancifully named elves. But researchers using instruments aboard the International Space Station were able to record two of these together. Torsten Norbert is here to talk about capturing these lightning-powered phenomena. Hi, Torsten.
Hello.
Okay, so what exactly did you see? What were the two TLEs that you were able to record?
Well, the first one was the ELB, which is a very fast expanding ring that appears in the ionosphere at 100 kilometers altitude, just above a lightning flash. And the other is what we call a terrestrial gamma ray flash, a TGF, which is a burst of high energy X-rays also from lightning. And we saw those two things together.
I saw an illustration that came in with your paper. This is something that I think is being considered for the cover or might be the cover. And it really just shows how spectacular these things are. Can you kind of describe that for the audience?
Yes, I'll try. If you sit on the space station and you look down over our beautiful planet, and then you see cloud cover and it's night and some of the clouds are reaching high altitudes in the atmosphere, like 17 kilometers or something, and they're illuminated by flashes inside so you can see the structure of the clouds. And then at some point, there's a big flash in the cloud, and this ring of emissions is just expanding from above the clouds horizontally to several hundred kilometers in a whitish, bluish type emissions. Of course, you don't see the X-rays.
These are from TGFs, or terrestrial gamma ray flashes, but they aren't exactly terrestrial, right?
Maybe I can go back a little bit here in time and explain how TGFs were observed in the first place. See, it's called terrestrial gamma ray flashes. It's kind of a strange name if you think about it. It's coined by people who actually were flying on satellites, X-ray instruments that looked out towards the cosmos to look at cosmic gamma ray bursts. So their detectors were geared to some different type of bursts at a much longer duration, and they were aimed towards cosmos and away from the Earth. But when they passed over thunderstorms, they saw sometimes very small, short duration, I should say, glimpses of gamma flashes. And that's why they call them terrestrial gamma ray flashes. Now, all the TGFs that were observed before our instruments came up in space were made by instruments looking out towards the cosmos. Mm-hmm. The curious thing is that these instruments, they're shielded. They're shielded so that X and gamma rays do not get in the wrong side of the detector. They only come from the side, the cosmos side, because then they can reduce the noise that they measure in the signals. However, flying above thunderstorms, you see thunderstorm gamma rays anyway. That's because they have such high energy. It's simply the highest energy natural phenomena that we have on the planet. We're talking about up to 40 MeV. 40 MeV, that is 40 million electron volts.
What is the context for that? Right?
It's more than 1,000 times higher energy photons than you receive at your dentist.
Wow.
So they were actually seeing them as, let's say, a noise contribution coming in from the backside.
With this new ISS instrument from the space station, you can see them differently.
With ASIM. ASIM is the instrument that we have on the space station. ASIM means the Atmosphere-Space Interactions Monitor. For the first time, we have designed instruments that look down on the Earth in X and gamma rays to measure these TGFs. So it's the first instrument that is specially designed to observe TGFs.
How common is it to see gamma ray flash, a terrestrial gamma ray flash?
Well, that's a really good question. How how often are TGFs generated? Well, you have to remember that the atmosphere is absorbing X-ray radiation. So that means that if you do it from ground, you have to be very close in order to observe them. But if the lightning is high in the cloud and we are on the space station as we are with our instruments, then there's not so much atmosphere between us, but we are at a larger distance. So we see maybe hundreds of these TGFs a year as we pass over thunderstorms. Probably they're just generated all the time, but since we are at a larger distance, we don't see them all.
Right. Do you know how terrestrial gamma ray flashes are generated by thunderstorms?
The TGFs are generated actually by electrons that are accelerated in thunderstorm electric fields to very high energy. And as they reach a high energy, they collide with the neutral atmosphere. And in that process, they generate this X-ray radiation. It's actually the same principle that is used in your dentist's office when you get X-rays of your teeth. It's a little electron gun inside this instrument that is hitting a target and then emitting the radiation. So the same thing, the same thing actually happens in thunderstorms.
What about this other event that you saw? This is an ELV, or in its long form, emission of light and very low frequency perturbations due to electromagnetic pulse sources. Somehow the acronym for that is ELV. What causes an ELV?
The ELV is a different animal. It is generated by a lightning stroke where the lightning channel actually acts like an antenna, and you have a pulsed current that flows through this antenna. So it emits electromagnetic radiation that propagates out. Some of it hits the ionosphere and excites particles up in the ionosphere, and they are illuminated just like the aurora is illuminated by energetic electrons. Then here the electromagnetic fields drag electrons in the ionosphere around, and they hit the neutrals and emit light, just like the aurora, actually.
Were you surprised to see a TGF and an ELV at the same time, or close to the same time?
Yeah, absolutely. If we go back a couple of years when all these processes were discovered, actually we go back to the 90s.
Yeah, not that long ago.
No, actually, 90s. And these sprites and ELVs and these TLEs, these optical flashes above thunderstorms, were discovered kind of by accident by a student. And everybody was in awe of all this above thunderstorms. We had to ask ourselves, how is it possible that something that you actually can see with your naked eye, that is happening above us and we didn't know about it?
Yeah. How long have we been looking at the heavens?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, of course, a lot of people got excited and they discovered new things all the way through the 90s and in 2000, all the way up till a couple of years ago. We discover a new animal every so often. The more we look, the more we see. In the beginning, we thought that TGFs were also at high altitude above the thunderstorms because the optical emissions like sprites up in the mesosphere at 80 kilometers altitude or ELVs at 90 kilometers altitude, they had just been discovered when the TGF was discovered. So they thought maybe they were related. And then later on, the estimates went down and down in the atmosphere, closer and closer to the thunderstorms. And now we know that they're generated by lightning inside the thunderstorms.
And so is that something that you learned from this observation?
This is something that we can pinpoint from this observation, what exactly is going on. And it is in the process of the lightning as it propagates in the cloud, and it takes a step forward. In our case with the ELV, it takes a final step before it reaches an opposite polarity layer and the whole thing discharges as a big short circuit.
This all happens in such a short amount of time, but there's just so much to learn even in those few milliseconds.
It's not just exotic things that we are looking at. We get a new understanding of lightning itself. When I explain this to people, I use the image of an anatomical atlas.
So a description of the human body.
Exactly, yes. And I remember as a kid, my parents had such a book and you could open this lids in this body and then you can see what was inside. There was a picture of a human body on the outside and then you open up the lid and you can see the lungs and then you can see. Yeah. So viewing in the upper atmosphere what happens gives us a new window into lightning, what really goes on into lightning. because these electrons, they must be accelerated to high energies to generate these TGFs. So it gives us a view of what really happens inside lightning. And we don't know that. I mean, what do we really know about lightning? We know that it's dangerous. We know what current flows and so on. But if I make a cross-section of lightning, how does it look inside? You know? I mean,
yeah.
I thought about it because you said it all happened so fast.
Yeah.
So how do you measure that? On top of that, it's dangerous. So what really happens inside lightning, it gives us a new view of that from our measurements.
ASIM isn't the only lightning game in space right now.
We are in a very, very special situation what regards lightning research, because the U.S. have launched last year, a year before, launched a satellite, meteorological satellite, to geostationary orbit. And they have a lightning mapper on for the first time. And ASIM is using the same principle of optical detection as they use on the geostationary satellite. They give just amazing resolution cloud measurements, and on top of that, the lightning measurements. I've seen some videos from those satellites. It's absolutely fantastic how you can see clouds develop and lightning starts to pop out. It's totally amazing. And Europe will have one similar in 2022.
This seems like a really good time to study lightning. What do you see as the really big questions in lightning research?
Well, for me, there's two aspects to it. One is that we would like to understand how the inside of lightning actually works. It's very difficult to model, but people are trying to do it. New computers, new algorithms, and so progress is being made. The other big question that I am thinking about is how do thunderstorms interact with the Earth's atmosphere, like modify chemically the composition, greenhouse gas concentrations, ozone, NOx. How do thunderstorms play into this whole climate thing with the atmospheric radiation balance?
Yeah.
What we see with ASIM is a lot of activity on thunderstorm cloud tops, which I don't think have been factored in. And I don't think people really understand if it could be important because it's so new.
Thank you so much, Torsten.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Torsten Neubert is in the Department of Astrophysics and Atmospheric Physics at the National Space Institute at the Technical University of Denmark. You can find a link to his paper at sciencemag.org/podcast. Just a reminder before you go, this episode is sponsored by Bayer. Bayer is helping advance stem cell therapy to repair heart tissue to keep hearts stronger longer. From advances in health to innovations in agriculture, Bayer is advancing science for a better life. At Bayer, this is why we science. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. You can subscribe to the show on the Science website. That's sciencemag.org/podcast. There you'll find links to the research and news discussed in the episode. You can subscribe, of course, on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Pandora, and many other places. The show was produced by Sarah Crespi and edited by Podigy. Special thanks to Megan Cantwell and Joel Goldberg. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.